From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
We explore why Marco Rubio may be the perfect guy to be President-elect Donald Trump's Secretary of State.
You have a politician like Marco Rubio who then knows the sensitivity associated with words like communism and socialism.
Also this week, despite some pushback from the legislative leadership, Governor DeSantis still wants lawmakers to tackle undocumented immigration during a special session later this month. We'll talk to an immigration attorney about it.
I don't think anybody who is reasonable is saying we don't need immigration reform. People are saying this is not the way to do it. It's not for states to do. They don't have the authority.
We'll also explore how California's wildfires are inflaming concerns right here in Florida, and we'll say goodbye to an historic Floridian who won respect from all ends of the political spectrum. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The Biden administration announced earlier this week it'll be removing Cuba from its state sponsors of terrorism list. The action came a day before Wednesday's Senate confirmation hearings for Senator Marco Rubio's Secretary of State nomination. Rubio has worked in the past to prevent Biden from removing Cuba from the list. Tristan Wood reports on how Rubio's roots, both as a Miami native and Cuban American, could influence his approach if confirmed to be the nation's top diplomat.
In 2022, Hialeah Mayor Esteban Bovo, speaking at Rubio's election night party, heaped heavy praise on the senator after he won re-election to a third term.
He's been here for a long time. He has made the difference, not just in Washington, but he did it when he was in Tallahassee. He has been a strong voice for those that can speak, especially for those in Cuba that seek freedom.
The city of Hialeah has the highest percentage of residents of Cuban descent compared to any other U.S. city. And Rubio got his political start representing a portion of this city back in 2000 in Florida's House of Representatives. Cuban Americans are also a big reason why Miami-Dade County turned red during the last presidential election. Last November, President-elect Donald Trump won 55% of the vote in Miami-Dade. When he first ran for president in 2016, he got 33%.
There are two things that made modern Miami. They are air conditioning and Fidel Castro.
That's Sean Foreman, political science professor at Barry University in Miami. He says the transformation of Miami's politics is the result of sustained outreach from Republicans. They've also tried to appeal to Cuban and Venezuelan Americans with anti-Castro and anti-communist messaging. Rubio has also embraced those political tactics. Here he is on the Senate floor denouncing Cuba's response to anti-government protests in 2021.
We should be clear in our language. We don't just condemn this tyranny. We condemn this communist, this Marxist, this socialist tyranny. Call it for what it is.
If confirmed as the first Cuban-American Secretary of State, Foreman thinks Rubio will sharpen his attacks.
Marco Rubio's political career, as well as his life as a Cuban-American, has been around this whole issue of maintaining a hard line against Cuba, but also against Venezuela and other Central American countries that may elect a left-leaning socialist type.
Rubio has also railed against China, so much so he was banned in 2020 from visiting the country. He was one of the first lawmakers that called for the banning of TikTok in 2019 out of concerns it would provide data to the Chinese Communist Party. Through further speeches on the Senate floor, like here in 2023, he continued to link his concerns over the social media app back to China's government.
The number one victims of the Chinese Communist Party are the Chinese people. But their government is very simple, guys. They want to be the world's most powerful country, and they want to do it at our expense.
Nikki Fried, chair of the Florida Democratic Party, says while it's important to take a stand against communism, Rubio also often messages on those issues for political gain.
You have a politician like Marco Rubio who then knows the sensitivity associated with words like communism and socialism, and you then weaponize those words for your own political advantage here in the United States, shame on you.
Last May, Trump was found guilty of 34 felonies in his hush money trial. Rubio compared that verdict to what people say they've experienced under the Cuban government. Here he is on Fox News' special report with Brett Baer.
They've been doing this against Trump for 7-8 years. The shock is that this could happen in America. I grew up listening to people tell me about show trials and things that happen in Cuba. This is a show trial.
Rubio's entire political career has been spent representing the state of Florida. But if nominated to be Secretary of State, His personal priorities will have to take a back seat to what his boss, Donald Trump, wants.
I'm Tristan Wood.
Governor Ron DeSantis wants lawmakers to come back to Tallahassee for a special session before the end of this month. He wants them to pass laws that would support President-elect Trump's immigration policies. Adrian Andrews sought the opinion of a prominent Tallahassee-based immigration attorney, Elizabeth Ricci. Her law firm, Rambana & Ricci, is a regular supporter of WFSU Public Media.
As far as the proposals that he wants passed in this upcoming special session, I think that it's a combination of things, unconstitutional, unfunded mandates, it's state overreach, and some of it's even much ado about nothing.
Now, when you say some of these are just being unconstitutional, what are some that really just sticks out to you, maybe like a red flag?
Well, one of the proposals is requiring money transfer companies to verify citizenship before allowing wire transfers. A couple of issues there. That interferes with interstate commerce. That's a federal issue. States can't control that, number one. Number two, it's going to discriminate against non-citizens who are here legally who would like to use wire transfers. So that's one. And then, of course, there's other issues that are not just constitutional issues, but unfunded mandates like requiring cities to participate in those agreements that diverts resources.
Something as aggressive as this that DeSantis is taking, have you seen that before?
I haven't seen a proposal as aggressive as this yet. I've seen bits and pieces, not just in Florida, but nationally. And what is unfortunate is it's going to cost the taxpayer at the end of the day to defend all of this. Students aren't going to be educated because there's a push for undocumented not to attend schools. Well, if they're not in school, they're not going to be able to get the kinds of jobs to support their family and contribute taxes. Are they leaving? Probably not. So now we have a less educated populace. If we're going to implement programs that racially profile people, that ends up making communities less safe while being an expense to taxpayers.
Well, I appreciate taking out this time. And really, like I said, I just wanted to get you on this call just so we can just go over and get your response.
I don't think anybody who is reasonable is saying we don't need immigration reform. People are saying this is not the way to do it. It's not for states to do. They don't have the authority. Let the federal government do what they should be doing. And in the meantime, states like Florida should be attending to the needs of everyday Floridians with things that they have authority to control and to improve.
All right, that is Elizabeth Ricci with Rambana and Ricci Law Firm that's right here in Tallahassee.
Thank you, Adrian. I appreciate you.
All righty, we'll talk soon.
That report from Adrian Andrews. Before we leave the topic of immigration, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, has been a lifeline for thousands who arrived in the U.S. as children. Even though it doesn't grant citizenship, for many it provides a safety net, but not without its own set of challenges and uncertainties. WGCU's Culture and Connections reporter Elizabeth Andarji takes us through one woman's journey.
For many, the term dreamer is a symbol of hope, but behind that word are stories of sadness, struggle, and often sacrifice.
I don't know. It's so frustrating because if I knew anything else, but I've known America all my life. You know, I was in kindergarten singing the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. All I know is here.
Meet Luz Maria Tubb, originally Luz Maria Castañeda, a DACA recipient. Her journey to the U.S. began 32 years ago.
My parents moved from Mexico with my sister and I, or with myself first, because I was 6 months old. And then at some point in those years, immigration got really bad. And so they were just kind of deporting everyone. And one of my last memories was laying down in like an RV type thing in the dark, hiding because they were having a Christmas party or something. And the neighbors had called the police and immigration showed up. My mom says that we packed our van with just the stuff that we had and drove all the way to Oregon. That was our initial move to the town that I grew up in.
The emotional weight of that moment didn't sink in at first. It wasn't until Tubb turned 15 that she realized her dream had turned into a dark discovery.
And I asked my mother, hey, mom, when can I go get my permit? And that's when she kind of let me know, you weren't born here. You don't have the same luxury as your friends. You don't get to go out and learn how to drive. I wouldn't say my world shattered, but it definitely made me look at things differently.
Little did she know that a change was about to take place a few years later. News spread like wildfire that the Obama administration had established the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And at 23 years old, Tubb received her first DACA card. For the first time, she could work legally. It was a milestone, but not without its own challenges.
I have it right here, the very first one that was given to me. But I've lost hope in this card because there was a time where I lost my ID and the only form of identification I had was this DACA card. I showed it to the TSA people. He looked at me and smirked and said, this isn't a valid ID. They would not allow me to go through TSA. Like, I had to talk to a bunch of different people. They had to pat me down to finally let me in. This card was so important. It signifies a lot, but at the same time, people aren't validating it.
Now a mother of two U.S.-born children, Tubb says the stakes feel higher than ever. DACA recipients are required to reapply every 2 years. If individuals want citizenship, it's encouraged to go back to their home country and lawfully re-enter the U.S.
And that's what's so frustrating, is that the lawyers that I've spoke to have given me the option of, okay, you can pay $17,000 to start the process, and you go to Mexico and you plead for forgiveness. What I was told is that their goal is to keep me there. That's so terrifying when you have two small kids who depend on you.
Despite the challenges, Tubb remains a fierce advocate for her peers.
Don't give up. But we're dreamers. We have a right to be here. And I say that with all the respect in the world. And I'm not saying it because I feel like we're entitled to it. But I do feel that we weren't given an opportunity to choose whether we wanted to come here or not. We were brought here young to tell us to, okay, well, now you know, go back. Go back to what?
I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
Americans are watching in horror as wildfires devastate Southern California. At least 27 people have died, tens of thousands of people have fled their homes, and thousands of emergency personnel are battling desperately to contain the flames. As Margie Menzel reports, the events have Floridians thinking about the courage of their own first responders here at home.
State Fire Marshal Jimmy Petronas has announced a request for $3.6 million in state funding to improve mental health care for the state's first responders, firefighters, law enforcement officers, dispatchers, and emergency medical personnel. In an October interview with WFSU, he reflected on the emotional toll first responders face in their daily jobs.
A three-year-old child had entered into a retention pond back in 2017 in Palm Beach County. And all I could think about is the child didn't make it. And some first responder had to go out there and wade into the retention pond to grab this child. And somebody had to go tell a mom and dad they're never going to hug their little baby ever again.
While most people flee natural and man-made disasters, first responders run to them. Firefighters, paramedics, and law enforcement officers were deployed to the Surfside condominium collapse, the Pulse nightclub and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas mass shootings, and a long string of hurricanes. First responders make up 1.4% of Florida's workforce, but their suicide rate is more than two times higher than the rate of working-age Floridians. That's why the Second Alarm Project deploys teams to communities where first responders are working, to help them cope with what they're seeing. The project began in 2019 in the wake of Hurricane Michael. Its teams include trained first responders who know the job and serve as peer support, along with trained chaplains, clinicians, and comfort dogs. This week, the Senate Children and Families Committee heard from the Second Alarm Project's Kelly O'Dare, its founder and leader. As she told them, the project is deeply personal to her. She's the spouse of a career firefighter paramedic and comes from a family of first responders.
My uncle, Sean O'Dare, gave his life in the line of duty as a Miami-Dade County firefighter rescuing a child trapped in an overturned vehicle submerged in a canal. And his legacy inspires me to advocate for the well-being of those who serve and protect our communities. This mission is my way of honoring him and supporting the first responder family I'm so proud to be a part of.
O'Dare says the state is at a pivotal point in the evolution of first responder mental wellness, with stigma decreasing and cultural shifts beginning to take hold.
This is a time of immense opportunity for growth, provided we harness lessons learned and address ongoing challenges. Awareness of first responder mental wellness has grown, but significant resource gaps, inconsistent practices, and an over-reliance on reactive measures hinder progress, particularly in underserved areas.
A coordinated statewide strategy is essential, says O'Dare, and her colleague at Second Alarm, firefighter Mike Bellamy, agrees. Bellamy's been on both sides of the need for support. He was deployed to the Surfside building collapse in 2021, where 98 people died.
I was at Surfside for a couple of weeks, and I remember the peer teams coming into our base camps where we were living in tent cities. And it was such a refreshing feeling to see a firefighter in this Second Alarm shirt walk in and put his arm around you and just say, "Hey, bud, I know this can't be easy. I've been there. Let's have a cup of coffee and catch up."
Now, as of January 1st, the Second Alarm Project has merged with UCF Restores at the University of Central Florida. UCF Restores not only serves first responders, but also military personnel, veterans, and survivors of mass violence and natural disasters. Bellamy says the merger provides the coordinated statewide strategy its advocates have been calling for.
It's proactive rather than reactive work. It's blue sky work. We're going in and building these programs out ahead of the event so that when the event occurs, we have a behavioral plan and access for those first responders.
UCF Restores specializes in the delivery of peer support training for first responders and public safety leaders. It also offers training to help licensed mental health clinicians provide effective support. For more information, visit WFSU.org. I'm Margie Menzel.
Lately, of course, so much of the news has focused on the wildfires threatening Los Angeles, but in Florida, the threat is more often coming from water. Homes, cars, and streets were flooded with rainwater for days, even weeks, after major Hurricane Milton pummeled parts of Florida back in October. The rainfall overwhelmed stormwater systems. Scientists blame human-induced global warming for contributing to the increased rainfall. It means flooding is not just a coastal problem for Floridians. It's an everywhere problem. WUSF's Jessica Massaros reports on what's being done to adapt old stormwater infrastructure to the new climate reality.
Nancy De La Cruz has lived in Tampa's University area neighborhood for about a year and a half. It's behind Fowler Avenue, which suffered devastating flooding after Hurricane Milton. She's showing me the thick gray water line that surrounds her one-story house. It's knee high. She couldn't enter her house. There was standing water for 5 days. A stormwater pond is just steps away from her home, and De La Cruz says it usually helps prevent flooding. But the pond couldn't help this time, she says, because water came from every direction. De La Cruz's neighbors, who've lived in the university area for over 30 years, told her they'd never seen flooding like this. Although her son is helping her to fix the damage, De La Cruz has lost almost everything and has trouble sleeping.
Estoy enferma del estómago, del estrés. No hay un día que no llore.
She's sick to her stomach from stress and says there isn't a day she doesn't cry. Nancy De La Cruz is one of many across the region who became a recent victim of flooding in unexpected areas, anywhere from 10 to 18 inches of rainfall. Florida's climatologist David Zierden says the amount of rain from tropical cyclones, tropical storms, and hurricanes is increasing and will continue to increase.
The theory is fairly simple. A warmer, moister atmosphere, also more fuel from warmer sea surface temperatures, provides more moisture for the storm to drop in these heavy rainfall events.
This is a climate issue, but it's also an infrastructure issue.
It's really hard to prepare for a 300-year storm and one of the strongest hurricanes, because none of our stormwater systems are designed for that kind of an event.
Taryn Sabia is an urban and community designer focusing on resilience with the University of South Florida. She's done some research on what's called blue-green urbanism.
So looking at how we can create more natural stormwater systems, ways of moving water through and to that isn't just about piping and pumping.
Like floodable parks, for example. But Sabia says Florida also has a lot of stormwater ponds, so she suggests reviewing if they function under these new rainfall conditions. Some residents and advocates say new construction around older neighborhoods has increased flooding. Sabia suggests taking new development into areas that are not as built out, preferably on higher ground.
There are, I think, a number of areas like that that we can look to in terms of providing both new development as well as areas that are safe for refuge so that people don't have to go as far to evacuate or find safety.
Hillsborough County is investigating the impacts recent storms had on its water systems. They're mapping, analyzing data, and getting public input. Phase one is expected to be completed by June. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
Former Brevard County School Board member Jennifer Jenkins last year launched Educated We Stand. She says it's aimed at protecting public schools from right-wing extremism. Jenkins talks about that on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, and here's an excerpt.
I founded Educated We Stand to be able to support and elect and protect school board members, not only in the state of Florida, but in other battleground states that are seeing the effects of this right-wing extremism bleeding into their school systems. And it's only been just a short time. It's been about 6 months, but we have been incredibly successful. And the outpouring of support has been overwhelming and really, really positive. And I'm just really proud of the people we were able to support in this past cycle. And I really look forward to what we've got going on going forward.
So you're recruiting school board candidates or you're supporting school board candidates. Tell us a little bit about how that works and what your success rate was in November.
So we launched just shy of 3 months before the Florida primary in August. Mm-hmm. And it was about just shorter than 6 months before November. And so we supported 25 candidates. The majority of them were in Florida. Some of them were in Michigan, and 80% of our candidates were successful against or opponents who were endorsed by Moms for Liberty and or Ron DeSantis if they were in Florida. Huh. So it's a tremendous success rate. Yeah. And the majority of those candidates weren't in safe spaces. I made it a priority stance to say, I'm not doing this just to have fake positive numbers and fluff. I want to make a difference and a change.
Right. I mean, that's meaningful if you're making those percentages, those kinds of wins, where there's truly a challenge, right? You're swimming upstream in many of those instances.
Yeah. And one of the most notable candidates that like I'm so excited about, I texted her immediately when the results came in, was Liz Barker in Sarasota County. And what's unique about that candidate is she's a first-time candidate. Sarasota County is unique because it votes for their school board members countywide, which actually makes it.
Oh, right.
It's a lot more expensive to run a race as a school board member there. People sure. often think of it as a down ballot ticket, but you have just as many voters as a state house rep and county commissioner. And it's a very red county. And as nonpartisan as these seats are.
Come on, they're not nonpartisan. You're saying nonpartisan. You're not even winking. They're really not nonpartisan. They're technically nonpartisan, but yeah. Are they really?
So I believe that they are and they should be. But what I mean by as much as we say that they are, I am not naive to the fact that the way politics plays here, right? The Republican Party of Sarasota and probably the state let every Republican in that county know that Liz Barker is a Democrat.
right.
So that's what I mean by that. But it is nonpartisan because the reality is when you're on that dais, aside from this culture war nonsense that was stirred up, really none of those decisions have anything to do with politics.
That was Educated We Stand Chairwoman Jennifer Jenkins on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. And you can hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Buddy McKay served the people of Florida for decades as a Democratic state legislator, congressman, lieutenant governor, and governor. He died on New Year's Eve at the age of 91 and was remembered this week at a spirited funeral service in Ocala, his birthplace. Steve Bosquet was there.
Bagpipes played outside the church where Buddy McKay was laid to rest Wednesday, a tribute to his Scottish ancestry. Inside, hundreds filled Fort King Presbyterian, the church McKay helped build in the 1960s as a welcoming place for people of all races. McKay's sons and grandsons told one funny story after another. A grandson recalled driving him to campaign events at age 12, hoping police wouldn't see them. McKay's son John, a Tallahassee doctor, said his father always drove home from the Capitol to his home in Ocala on U.S. 19, the back way, through towns like Cross City, Steinhatchee, and Otter Creek.
Just because that was kind of what he really enjoyed. He wasn't much for the interstate and everything looking exactly the same no matter which exit you went to. So all of those little small towns, he just felt at home there and enjoyed it.
The service attracted dozens of political figures who served with McKay and Lawton Chiles, the last Democrat elected governor in 1990. Former Governor Bob Martinez, who lost to Chiles and McKay and who just turned 90, was there.
You know, he was straight as an arrow. He was very thoughtful, very thorough, and was not afraid to express the views he might have had, even if they were contrary to popular belief. So you can't ask for more than that.
Former Senator Rick Dantzler of Winter Haven was McKay's running mate in that race for governor in 1998. They lost badly to Jeb Bush, but Dantzler said he admired McKay's philosophical nature.
I can remember a time when we were in South Florida and we had gotten some bad campaign news, and it just kind of rolled off his shoulders, and he said, well, Rick, you know, tomorrow's another day. But he just stayed very philosophical about it, didn't dwell on it, didn't get mad. He had a balance in his life that seemed to allow him to weather those storms really well.
McKay spent three decades in politics but never realized his dream to become a U.S. senator or to get elected governor. He held the office for 3 weeks after Chiles died in December 1998, shortly before leaving office. John McKay said he hears from people who wish his father were still around.
When people in Tallahassee remember him to me, they're like, my gosh, look at what politics has become. Couldn't we get your dad back?
Family and friends recalled a devoted father and grandfather, a man of integrity and faith, a believer in racial integration when it wasn't popular, and a man with a sly sense of humor and a deep affection for Florida's natural environment. I'm Steve Bosquet in Ocala.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Elizabeth Anderjay, Jessica Mazaros, Derek Ham, and Steve Bosquet. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.